Monica, do you want to call the court into session?
Yes. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The court is now in session. The judges are Judge Frisch, Judge Gaitis, and Judge Hallbrooks, the Honorable Theodora Gaitis presiding.
Good morning. It's nice to see you both. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 2nd, 2022, and we are holding our proceedings this morning via the Zoom platform. We have five cases on our calendar this morning, three for oral argument and three non-oral matters. And this is our first oral case of the day. Counsel, I just want to make sure that you can see the clock that is keeping time this morning. All right. And I know you're both very familiar with our court rules. I would just make a few requests. Keep track of your time via the clock. And when you're not speaking, just make sure that you mute your microphone. And with that, are we ready to proceed? All right. So the case is A21-1038 State versus Trayvon Dominic Miller. And we will begin with counsel for appellant.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Eitenauer. I'm an attorney at the Office of the State Appellate Public Defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Trayvon Miller. Mr. Miller asked this court to reverse the revocation of his probation. I raised four issues for your consideration. The state suggests that it's not necessary for this court to review the first issue, which is the district court's finding of violation for failing to remain law-abiding. Even if we all agree that there are some problems with the district court's finding of violation for failing to remain law-abiding, this court must still remand for the district court to review the merits of revocation and make adequate findings pursuant to Austin and Motland, and to consider whether revocation is still appropriate based on any remaining findings of violation. The district court's decision here was heavily focused on Mr. Miller's criminal history as a basis of revocation. And without this clearly erroneous finding of violation for failing to remain law-abiding, it might very well have continued probation. That being said, the district court also erred in finding there was clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Miller violated probation by not completing treatment and by using or possessing firearms. The standard requires that the truth of the facts submitted is highly probable, though less than a reasonable doubt. Here, the specific condition prohibited Mr. Miller from using or possessing firearms. The district court merely found that a violation occurred when weapons and ammunition were found at his residence. The district court did not find that he used or possessed the firearms. The court based its conclusion in part on its finding that the...
Ms. Eitenauer, just to stop you there for one moment, are you contesting the fact that firearms that were the weapons that were found in the apartment?
No, we acknowledge that the firearms were found in that apartment, but it was a shared residence. Mr. Miller was found in the residence along with other people. The police were there looking for somebody else. It was leased to Ms. Marple. I don't believe his name was even on the lease, or there wasn't evidence that it was. There are numerous items belonging to other people there. There was no evidence that he had exclusive control over the firearms, or that he had used them or possessed them. And the district court didn't find that there was a strong probability that he was exercising dominion and control over them. They merely found that he was tied to the firearms by a preponderance of evidence due to the DNA and the circumstances. But
was he present in the apartment when the search occurred?
Yes, I believe he was. As was Ms. Marple, there was another person there. And the police were there looking for another person that wasn't even found there altogether. So this case, I likened it to State v. Harris, where the defendant in that case was a driver in a vehicle with two other passengers. A firearm was found in the ceiling of the vehicle. And this court found that that was insufficient circumstantial evidence that the driver was in possession of the firearm, even though his DNA was found in a mixture of DNA on that firearm. And this case is very similar to that. And the district court clearly erred in finding that Mr. Miller used or possessed these firearms when they were merely tied to him by being in this shared residence. And so it's our position that that does not rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence. Additionally, the district court erred in finding that Mr. Miller violated his probation conditions by failing to complete treatment. There was still time remaining on Mr. Miller's probation period. His probation had actually been extended and was set to expire on December 19th of this year, 2022. The probation violation hearing was held on May 28th of 2021. There was plenty of time for him to complete treatment during that period of time that was left. Additionally, the court could have extended probation if necessary to accommodate a treatment completion. So there were other options here. And so the district court finding that, I'm sorry.
Can I ask some questions about this particular violation? I mean, it seems to me when I'm looking at the court's revocation order that all of the factors have been satisfied here. The district court found that there was clear and convincing evidence that he failed to complete treatment. The district court specifically credited evidence that he did not complete treatment, found that the violation was intentional and inexcusable, and then went through the factors in determining that revocation was appropriate. Is there some defect that you're pointing to in the district court's order that renders the revocation improper? I'm not seeing where the defect is here.
Sure. So with regards to the finding a violation for treatment, the court clearly erred because Mr. Miller still had time to complete treatment, and the court found that he failed to complete treatment, and that was a violation of his probation condition. So that's clearly erroneous.
But he was discharged. I mean, the district court made credibility determinations in paragraph 4 of the findings of fact that he was discharged, he missed multiple sessions, he wasn't engaged, he was, you know, not doing the things that he needed to do to complete treatment. And so that seems like there's clear and convincing evidence that he did not complete treatment. He was enrolled in a program and he didn't complete the program. The fact that he could complete a program in the future doesn't negate the fact that he didn't complete the program that he was enrolled in, right?
Well, Your Honor, this is similar to Davison. In Davison, that was a situation where this court found that there was still time remaining for that defendant to get an evaluation while he was on probation. There was no deadline imposed. There's nothing here that says he has to have the treatment completed with 2 years left on his probation period.
So if somebody's on probation for, we don't do this anymore, but somebody's on probation for a 20-year period of time and they go to sex offender treatment and they're discharged, and they go to sex offender treatment again and they're discharged because they're not completing treatment. Is it your position that the district court can never revoke probation because there's still time to complete treatment in that 20-year period, even though the probationer is not making satisfactory progress towards the completion of the condition?
Well, Your Honor, I'd first like to point out that that's not the situation here. This was the first discharge from sex offender treatment. Maybe that would be an issue, but one of the things that the court pointed to in Davison is that one of the things that they could have done is said promptly complete treatment or used any kind of qualifier. And there's no qualifier or deadline. There's no language here whatsoever to put Mr. Miller on notice that he has to complete treatment by a certain period of time. And so that's part of the issue here. Additionally, Mr. Miller, unlike in other situations, is motivated to complete treatment. He testified that he wanted to complete treatment. There are numerous treatment programs in the area. He could try a different program. Just because this one failed doesn't mean another one is not going to be successful.
So I'm not aware.
Could you go ahead? Sorry, Judge Frisch. I was just going to ask you to respond to Judge Frisch's comments about the court's credibility determinations, because they seem to stand in the way of that argument you just advanced.
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that the court, although the court found that he missed multiple sessions, the court ultimately and found that he was discharged from treatment, which is true. What the court didn't address is the fact that he still had time remaining on the probation period during which he could have completed treatment. One of the things that the court pointed to was the lack of participation in treatment based on the discharge summary. What the discharge summary also pointed out is that he had only been in treatment for approximately a month and he missed 3 sessions, one of which because he was in custody, he'd been arrested. So there are a lot of factors that you play into this as well.
Is there any authority that supports your proposition that just because there's time left on in a probationary period and someone hasn't completed a treatment program that they've been enrolled in fact, has been affirmatively discharged from that program for failure to comply with the conditions, that cannot form the basis of a probation violation or a revocation of probation? I'm not aware of any.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any either directly on point. But what I would point you to again is this court's decision in Davison, which is very similar to the situation where the probationer had an undetermined amount of time in which to comply with the condition. And in this case, we've got a probationer who was motivated to comply with the condition. Just moving on from the treatment issue, there are other issues too with the court's findings here, as far as the court's finding that the violations were intentional and inexcusable. The court concluded that he presented no credible legal excuse for the violations. Yet the district court did not explicitly find that he intentionally and inexcusably violated probation when the firearms were found in that shared residence. And merely being tied to the firearms did not establish that he intentionally and inexcusably possessed or used them. The court did not explicitly find that he intentionally and inexcusably violated probation for failing to remain not law-abiding. And notably, there were no violations or convictions for new crimes here either. The court simply made a blanket finding without breaking it down. And I think that's a problem in the situation where there's a lot of evidence here that the violations were not intentional and inexcusable. And finally, the district court didn't address the third prong either. There was no balancing of freedom and the state's interest in public safety. And when a district court fails to articulate this justification as it did here, this court will reverse the revocation of probation. The record here establishes, if you look at the record as a whole, even if this court were to look at the record, despite the lack of findings, there are intermediate sanctions that were discussed that exist out there. The probation officer pointed out that correctional treatment was not an option. He was not going to be able to get treatment in prison because he didn't have enough time on his sentence. There are intermediate sanctions out there, such as halfway houses, group homes, sober homes, supportive living environments that could have addressed some of these issues, or inpatient treatment. And so I think, without the court having considered that either, we've got another issue. So all three prongs of Austin and Motland have issues in this case. And so I think it's important for this case to reverse the revocation of his probation, and at the very least, remand to the district court. And if the court has no further questions right now, I will yield.
Thank you, Ms. Leitner.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, let's wait until the clock is ready for you. And we want that to say 15. You may proceed. Perfect. You can have a few extra seconds.
Oh, I hope not to use them. May it please the court, counsel John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm because the district court had ample evidence and reason to revoke appellant's probation. As to the prior convictions, three issues with that. Number one, the court doesn't need to consider that in its analysis for the probation ratification. The fact that Mr. Miller possessed firearms and failed to complete the sex offender treatment are sufficient and independent basis to revoke probation. Both were proven by clear and convincing evidence. The convictions, although not necessary, simply just show a history of failing to remain law-abiding. It provides support for the overall fact that confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation.
Mr. Schmidt, just to interrupt you there, the district court didn't rely on those prior convictions for that purpose. It seems to me, looking at the order, that the court relied on those convictions as a violation, one of the three violations. And if that's the case, would you acknowledge that at least as to that basis, it was improper for the court to again rely on some convictions that had been used as a basis for a previous violation?
I don't think they should have been used here, but I don't think that should make it so this court reverses or remands. And I don't think a remand is necessary because the State versus Wirt case simply doesn't require a remand and doesn't apply. And were this case reverse, this court reversed because one of the violations was not sufficiently proven, and that was a failed drug test. The court noted that there were two other violations, one of which was failing to finish an 8-hour treatment program. The other was failing to complete a longer treatment program. But the court noted that one of those two violations may have been tied to the failed drug test. So it's unclear based on that record whether there was one violation remaining or whether there were two. And as such, it was appropriate to remand in that case to have the district court sort that out. Here, the record is clear that the other violations are independent from the prior convictions, and that they are both serious violations with the possession of two different firearms and failing in the sex offender treatment program. And based on that independent reasons, those are both sufficient to affirm the district court in its revocation of the probation here.
Can I just clarify, counsel, is it the state's position that or let me just ask it a little differently. You're conceding that it was improper for the district court to revoke probation on the basis of a failure to remain law-abiding violation. Is that correct?
You know, I didn't dig into it enough because I don't think they should be used in the analysis. So yes, I will concede that they shouldn't have been used. Yeah, I think it's just cleaner to do it that way. They were previously dealt with. They were probation was extended for them. So to use them again as another violation when they've already been used in the past, I don't think should have been used here. But again, I don't think reversal and remand is required.
Mr. Schmidt, could you respond to appellant's argument with respect to the firearms? I mean, clearly the district court comments upon the DNA profile, but and it says ultimately the evidence ties Mr. Miller by a preponderance of the evidence to at least two of the firearms found in the residence. Is that a sufficient finding for our purposes?
Yes. And it's because of the standard that exists here. And it's a different standard in State versus Harris. State versus Harris, it was a conviction of possessing a firearm. The standard there is beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, it's the preponderance of the evidence and the fact that he was in the apartment, that he was tied to the apartment, and that his DNA was found on at least two of the guns. The court limited it to those two guns, where his DNA was tied to those firearms. So, yes, it is appropriate for the guns to be used as a probation violation.
I am a little confused about the use of that preponderance of the evidence standard when, the standard for probation revocation is clear and convincing evidence. What is your understanding of the use of that preponderance of the evidence standard? And is it erroneous? I guess this is a compound question. Is it erroneous for a district court in determining whether a new offense has been committed to find by preponderance of the evidence that one has been, and then by clear and convincing evidence that that amounts to a violation of probation?
You know, I think given the standard, I think it meets either standard. I do agree clear and convincing should be the standard here in proving the violations. But even under that standard, with all the evidence that exists here, given that he was at the apartment, his DNA was on two of the guns, that standard is met in this case. And I think it's important to look too, the district court did a very careful analysis here. It wasn't just saying, here's all the violations that the state alleges, and I'm going to agree with every single one. The court was careful to limit it to just two of the firearms, and the ones specifically with his DNA connected to him. The court said the state had not met its burden of proof as to the drug offense, which was also charged in the firearm. The court said the state had not met its burden of proof with the sexual conduct charges that were pending against him, and said those don't satisfy the burden. So the court wasn't just adopting all the violations that the state put before it. It held the state to the burden and said that there are specific violations that exist here, one of which is the firearms and the other which is the sex offender program, failure to complete that. And I think based on those two violations, which both meet the standard here, this court should affirm. And unless the court has any other questions, I will just rest on the briefs.
I'm sorry, I do have one last question for you, just when you think you're off the hook. I'm wondering if you could address the argument that Ms. Eitnauer has made that there was an insufficient finding on the part of the district court that the violations were intentional or inexcusable. I mean, what does that mean for the purpose of a probation violation, that something's intentional or inexcusable?
I disagree that the finding was insufficient on those grounds. I think the in paragraph 3 on page 4, the court said defendant Trajan Miller's violations were intentional and inexcusable. And the court goes on and talks about some of the reasons why they're intentional and inexcusable. And at the end of that, the court said he presented no credible legal excuse for the probation violations in this matter. So the court heard his testimony, but rejected the idea that he was motivated to complete treatment, rejected the idea that this wasn't his gun and this was somebody else's gun, or he never possessed these guns. And so rejected the testimony and the legal excuses that he tried to provide. And in within that paragraph did find violations were intentional and inexcusable. And I think the findings there are sufficient.
Thank you.
So do you want to address the argument that there was additional time remaining on probation for the defendant to complete sex offender treatment and that revoking probation on that basis was improper?
Sure. I think Davison is distinguishable. In Davison, you have a situation where there was a delay in obtaining a psych evaluation. In that situation, you can look at time remaining, because yes, there may be a delay, but that psych evaluation had never actually started. So the additional 6 months that existed on probation is sufficient to give that person time to go and complete it. In this situation, the district court was clear that here, Mr. Miller started within the program and failed and was discharged from the sex offender treatment program. And then the court also found there was no legal excuse for the probation violations. And that finding itself shows that he wasn't motivated to complete treatment. He hadn't restarted treatment after he failed out of the program and was discharged for it. So my at the basis, the argument is, if you've started something like a sex offender treatment program, then you have, since you started it, if you failed out, then that can be a violation. If you haven't started it, then it's something that maybe you can look at how much time is left on the probation to figure out whether there is sufficient time to complete it. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. We're going to let you off the hook now, Mr. Schmidt. Thank you for your argument. And we'll get the clock set. And Ms. Eitnauer, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you care to provide a rebuttal.
Thank you. I just wanted to touch on a few points real quick here. Ultimately, this court must remand for the district court to review the merits of revocation and make adequate findings pursuant to Austin and Motland based on the fact that the first reason for revocation was the new criminal convictions that was erroneous, as the state has conceded now. And the district court needs to consider whether revocation is still appropriate based on any remaining findings of violation, which it's still our position, are clearly erroneous here as well. The DNA evidence and the evidence regarding the firearm merely tied him to the firearms, which is not enough to meet the clear and convincing standard that it's highly probable he used or possessed the firearms. The preponderance evidence standard is the incorrect standard. It is a probation violation hearing the court. Although the court found it was established by clear and convincing evidence, it enlisting and considering the evidence only found that the evidence rose to a preponderance of evidence standard. Additionally, with regards to the finding of intentional and inexcusable violations, the court made just a blanket finding and did not specifically mention the firearms in conjunction with that finding. The firearms are not mentioned in that paragraph at all. And I just also wanted to respond to the state's argument that if Mr. Miller had started and failed treatment, that that's the problem here, and he didn't restart treatment. Well, he didn't restart treatment because he was discharged after he was arrested and taken into custody. So it doesn't appear that he had the opportunity to restart treatment. That wasn't something that would have been available to him. And I don't think it makes sense to differentiate this from Davidson in the sense that Mr. Davidson had never started obtaining an evaluation. And yet here we've got Mr. Miller, who did actually take steps to try to comply with probation and try to meet the conditions, unlike the defendant in Davidson, who hadn't done so. And so I think that's important to keep in mind as well.
I just want to make one thing clear. Are you arguing that when someone is arrested and that's a basis for failure to complete programming, that's some kind of a legal excuse for the purpose of revocation?
Your Honor, I'm just pointing out the circumstances of this situation here. The state seems to think the fact that he didn't restart treatment is important. And I just wanted to point out for this court the reason why he didn't restart treatment is likely because he was in custody. And so I think that's prohibited him from attending treatment programming at Alpha. Ultimately, Wirt is directly on point here as far as this court should remand the case if it finds that there are any remaining violations for the district court to reconsider. This court has done that previously in Campbell and Michael. Both of those cases referenced earlier orders in the procedural history of those cases in which this court had done similar things where the district court's findings in probation revocation matters were insufficient. And so for all those reasons, we're asking that you reverse the finding of revocation here.
Okay, thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us.